Hello again, and welcome back to Series 2 of The Good Stuff, a podcast from The Wheel that brings you news, views, and inspiring voices from the Irish non-profit sector. I'm Emily Burke, and I'm here once again to talk with leading representatives from our sector about resilience during the COVID-19 crisis. In this episode, we'll be looking at the resilience of ideas. For much of the early stage of the crisis, community was at the forefront of our national conversation, and there was a widespread acknowledgement that we need to prioritise an economy that serves society as opposed to a society that serves the economy. But as we settle into a longer-term reality, how do we sustain the momentum, resist pushback, and create concrete policy change? Today, we speak to Michelle Murphy from Social Justice Ireland and Claire Brophy from the Abortion Rights Campaign about policy, grassroots activism, and proven strategies for change. Once again, because of ongoing restrictions, we weren't able to speak in person, so they kindly agreed to talk to me virtually. I started by asking Michelle about approaching policy asks from the perspective of an organisation like Social Justice Ireland.
My name is Michelle Murphy. I am a research and policy analyst with Social Justice Ireland. Social Justice Ireland, we're an independent social justice think tank. Our website is socialjustice.ie. And now my role as a research and policy analyst is to research and analyse trends in areas such as income distribution, sustainability, rural development, taxation, education, and look at perhaps trends in terms of socioeconomic inequality, urban-rural divide, gaps between students from disadvantaged backgrounds and their peers, how we're doing in terms of climate, analyse those sorts of trends, look at the latest research, engage in research, and then I suppose it's policy as well. So then how can you translate your findings into policy? How can you develop policies that will improve the situation for particular groups and particular cohorts? And then a very important part of the role is then how do you communicate this policy, both in terms to your members, to stakeholders, to politicians, to civil society, and to the media itself and to partners in order to advocate for policy change and get policy change implemented?
I suppose when I was thinking about questions I might ask you for this, the first one that came to mind was that this is something very new, but it's hardly the first major world upheaval. Do these big shifts change the way people approach policy?
Events like this, and this particular event is new because the shock was so immediate, you know, in terms of job losses, global economies going into a deep freeze, essentially. The social shock as well, it's been immediate compared to other events such as the financial crash in 2008, where it was an incremental shock. So in a way, these events can make policy advocacy more difficult because the immediate crisis naturally tends to take over and how you respond to the immediate crisis. So issues that, you know, may have been to the fore prior to the crisis then can be pushed into the background and you can lose ground. And I suppose one from 2008, we've actually just published a study last week, A Rising Tide Failing to Lift All Boats. It's part of our European series. And we published a number of reports looking at the crash in those countries most impacted. But this looks at the EU as a whole. And what you see is that in the 10 years since the crash, looking at access to services in particular, certain member states, people lost access or had reduced access to health services in particular after the crash, you know, due to public expenditure cuts and various other things. But those in the lower socioeconomic groups have never regained that access. What you do see often is that those who are already at a disadvantage prior to any sort of crisis generally have the least amount of resources in terms of dealing with that's both personal resources, your social supports and your financial resources. So they're the ones that tend to be left behind as we recover. So I suppose that's a challenge now to ensure that those groups who are in a very vulnerable position prior to February and the onset of COVID-19 are not left behind as we sort of slowly move our economy and society out of a deep freeze.
I suppose the crash is a reasonably recent event, even now in our minds. There's been a lot of maybe lessons learned about austerity in the wake of it. Do you think there's an opportunity in terms of pursuing policy change that is so recent in our minds?
Yes, I actually do, because one thing that this situation has done is put a spotlight on particular issues. So it's really made us think about what is important in terms of our society and economy, what roles are vital to keep our economy and society going. And you know, what are kind of superfluous or what things seemed so important a couple of months ago, but actually are not that important at all and are not that relevant. So, you know, how can we prioritize our social and economic priorities? And after the financial crash, you know, we didn't do that. There was just a tendency to assume what we need to do is get back to business as normal. And the first thing we're going to do is reduce public expenditure so we can reduce the deficits. I think now certainly there's an acknowledgement that that wasn't a good idea at the time. It was the wrong policy and it certainly isn't going to be implemented now. So you need to look back further. So look at things like John Maynard Keynes, like the beverage report and the times that those sorts of things were implemented. For example, post-World War II, the world economy was in an absolutely dire state. So not only had we had an economic crisis, there'd been a devastation, a human social devastation for years, particularly in Europe. And yet look at what came out of that in terms of the beverage report for the United Kingdom and the ambition that was contained in there. And I think that now is an opportunity. We have an opportunity now to be really ambitious and rethink where we're going as a country, as an economy, as a society, what policies and what areas we should be prioritizing, and then look at how we might get there. And one simple example is the urban-rural divide has been quite pronounced over the past decade or more, but particularly in the past 5 years, while there's been, you know, a lot of economic growth in Ireland, but you could say that it hadn't exactly trickled outside Dublin. But now, remote working all of a sudden has become the norm. And this presents a huge opportunity for the regions and rural Ireland in terms of being a very, they're already attractive places to live. Quality of life is generally better, but now you can offer people career opportunity. That has been a game changer for those areas. So if we can invest in the broadband infrastructure, roll it out, front load that investment, invest in smart villages, get the regional economic development zones, investing in hubs so people can remote work. If they don't want to remote work in their own home, there is a hub they can go to, which has all the facilities that they need. So that is a game change, one game changer, I would argue. And that's a positive that can be built on.
And a very sudden positive that's come into our lives as well.
Exactly. So a lot of the changes, I mean, that is why this crisis is so different, for example, to the crash in 2008, is that the change was so immediate. You know, in a number of weeks, our economy had basically shut down and there was a huge, almost a million people reliant on some sort of payment from the state for income support. Because the change was so quick and so immediate, we have an opportunity now to build on it, to reflect on what it is we actually want. What lessons have we learned? What is vital to our society and economy, and what are the values that we should be prioritizing as we now look at what sort of investment we're going to make to get ourselves back on our feet and also, you know, meet our climate obligations. And one area I think that really a light has been shone on is the value of community. Community and voluntary organizations, the community and sector up and down the country, and those people, groups and organizations in every single town and village whose work generally often goes under the radar, it's suddenly been shown that they're a vital cog in the delivery of public services and social infrastructure. And we need to seize on this opportunity to promote the value of the community and voluntary sector and build on this and embed support for the sector.
To me, when I think about resilience, one of the challenges to my mind is sustaining the momentum of that change over time. How do you see the concept of resilience fitting into that kind of policy work?
I think resilience, it's going to be incredibly important, and it always has been in terms of policy work, because bringing about policy change is a very long, very slow process. It doesn't happen overnight. And as you mentioned there, and it's really important to point this out, there's two obvious challenges facing the sector. The first one is funding. Funding for the sector was cut after the financial crash, and it's never recovered from that, and the funding has never been brought back up to where it was prior to 2008. But the second issue, which is really important, is the issue of fatigue. You know, naturally, people are going to be fatigued by the present situation. Both politicians will be fatigued, and also the general public itself. So the challenge is keeping your items on the agenda and keeping them relevant. So all the items in the community and voluntary sector prior to the onset of COVID-19 are still going to be just as valid after it. But the challenge for us as a sector will be, how do we align ourselves, or how do we align our priorities and our policy work in a way to keep it relevant to the current situation? So, you know, policy change is generally a series of incremental steps, and it's compromises before you can reach your goal. It's constantly engaging civil servants with politicians, the media, stakeholders, the public, to keep your items on the agenda, to forge alliances, and in a way, it's actually repeating yourself over and over and over and over again. It means adapting to changing circumstances. So being resilient enough to adapt to the changing circumstances, the current crisis being an obvious example. And how does the sector and the sector's policy priorities fit into these changed circumstances? And how do we keep our policy priorities on the agenda? How do we make sure they're front and centre, they're not ignored, they're not forgotten about, and that they're not left behind? And how does the sector itself build on, you know, I suppose the goodwill, for want of a better word, of the past performance, because the value of the sector has been highlighted. The sector is incredibly valuable, but the sector needs to be resourced. And I think the sector is incredibly resilient, but people do get fatigued by trying to bring about change. So I do think it's important that community and voluntary organisations don't become dispirited. Policy change will come, but it's a question of adapting your priorities, fitting them into the new reality in the new environment.
A lot of them will be reassessing policy asks or strategies for presenting those asks. Is there general advice you would put out there for people doing that in this climate?
What I would say to organisations is prioritise your asks, divide them into short, medium and long-term goals, because ultimately most organisations, the policy priorities or your strategies won't have changed. But what you have to do is find a way to make your policies asks heard and your strategies relevant in our new reality. We, as a country, have to make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past and focus only on getting our economy up and running and leaving everything else as an afterthought. Mm. Because we know that didn't work last time, it won't work again, because, you know, it is a challenge keeping issues on the agenda, such as poverty, child poverty, income inequality, you know, the lack of statutory home help hours, the broadband infrastructure, keeping community development on the agenda, and other issues that don't get the headlines that other issues do. It can be difficult to keep them on the agenda, but they're just as relevant now as they were a number of months ago. The challenge for the sector, I suppose, is to continue to advocate and to engage and to represent, because what we must remember now is that the sector has also taken on some new roles since the crisis began in terms of being the linkage between some public services and the delivery of those services within the community and reaching more vulnerable members of the community, so that, you know, they know what sort of new COVID services are out there, and also in terms of getting the information out there. And so those are all new roles that the sector has taken on as well. So the sector has to balance that, and it has to be appreciated, I would say, at a government level, at the value of the sector, the services it provides, the role it provides, you know, the people it represents, and that the issues that are a priority for the sector should be priority issues for government as well, because they reflect those issues that are important to communities up and down the country. The sector has always bridged the gaps, and it's been a vital, I suppose, resource, and often underappreciated resource in terms of bridging those gaps where the state or government itself hasn't stepped in. Now we're reliant on the sector, or government is reliant on the sector even more to bridge those gaps. So it's highlighted the importance of the sector, and I think certainly that's something that the sector can use to its advantage to ensure that those gaps are addressed, because those gaps are persistent. They have persisted over time, and they haven't been addressed by successive governments. A lot of those gaps, it wouldn't cost a huge amount of money to address them. Some of them would, but others, it doesn't cost a huge amount of money. And sometimes that's also the challenge. If your issue isn't headline, front and centre and enormous, it can tend to get lost. But, you know, those gaps can be addressed. The sector has shown how they can bridge those gaps, how you can provide services to people. The challenge now is to make sure the government actually intervenes, looks at long-term multi-annual funding, looks at implementing policies that will address those issues that the sector has identified. And the, you know, the challenges that we see now, and also the challenges that are coming down the line as well, which, you know, the sector is well placed to be able to identify those for government.
I suppose to wrap up, speaking more to the people themselves who are trying to drive this change, it's tough work. It's hard to keep it going. Do you have any words of wisdom for people trying to implement policy change over the long term to stay resilient?
It is tough work. It's tough to keep going. My only advice is to continue to repeat yourself over and over and over and over again, because over time you will begin to see change. It's never immediate, but you'll begin to see change. Do not be afraid to repeat yourself. It will feel like you're repeating the same message consistently, and perhaps you think people are tired of hearing that message, but they're not. They need to hear that message. They need to continually hear that message. And that's when you see the incremental change. And one thing I would point out to is, you know, when this crisis began, we were one of the organizations which saw it as an opportunity to push the concept of a new social contract, which we've been doing since 2016, if not prior to that, but 2016, we made a real push on that, you know, given the centenary year that was in it. But this time around, and we're not the only organization who's been pushing it, but I think we've certainly had a large role in it. Suddenly it has caught on in the public consciousness. And so you see now that the social contract, you know, became part of the narrative, the public narrative. When you can start getting your message out there and it becomes part of the narrative, then you will begin to see change.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Emily. Delighted.
Next, I was keen to hear about change and sustaining it at the grassroots level, which is where Claire came in.
My name is Claire Brophy. I'm a founder member and a former co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign. I was one of the core organisers of Strike for Repeal, and I was on the mobilisation team for Together for Yes. And then I also did a PhD on the mother, the body and the body politic. So those things kind of intersected. So that's what I'm all about.
That's quite a lot of things to be all about. From your campaigning experience, do you think this is a real opportunity for lasting change? Is it a unique moment for campaigners?
I definitely think that it is. I think it's a unique moment for everyone in every respect. And so one of the things that the crisis has compelled everyone to do, or forced everyone to do really, whether we want to or not, is to do some introspective thinking about whether the things that we're doing in our lives matter, or whether we're doing enough good. It's made people reevaluate how exactly we spend our time, how we're spending our lives. And I think that period will be really important and valuable for social movements that are already happening and that will happen in the future. And it's not necessarily just about your work. A big part of it, of this crisis, has awoken people to how they spend their free time, because it's become so blurred in the past few months. It's making people realise that our activism, or your intent as a campaigner or just as a person, it can be as small or as great as you make it. So more people are recognising that it's every facet of your life. People are starting to realise that we all have a social responsibility to each other, just as people. So there's an immense power to that, and it's really empowering. And hopefully as people become more empowered and realise that their choices matter and have very direct effects, that they also recognise the responsibility they have to do better. People are starting to realise that it's not something you can opt out of. Not only is the alternative possible, but it's entirely plausible and realistic, and knowledgeable people and people who know better and people who have lived experience have been shouting from the rooftops about how we could be better at this all along. Mm-hmm. So there's a moment of humility and saying, actually, yeah, now's the time to put all of our energy and everything that we have behind people. And I think once affected people are front and center of any movement, and we put our support and everything that we have behind them, it can only be a good thing.
As a seasoned campaigner yourself, what strategies do you see as really important in keeping social change at the top of the agenda?
The way out of this, and the way forward, and the way to make everything better, is to listen to radical points of view and to be really imaginative about how we can restructure things for a better world for everybody. Not as a favour, because it's right, because this is the way it should have always been. And something really, really went wrong with, Rosie Bardotti calls it, I think, advanced capitalism, that it's sort of end stage and that it has become this monstrous thing that very few people can live very freely in. If we're kind of open-minded about how this all looks, the best way to sustain momentum is to keep the focus on affected groups, and that can be across any campaign. The best way to elicit understanding is to simply listen to people who have been affected. If you think you're unaffected, or if you think you're disconnected from the movement, listen to the stories of people who are, and you'll start to just, as a human being, realise that it's not enough to be an empathetic onlooker, that it's actually essential now to get stuck in and do whatever you can. And that's the other thing, I think, actually, about sustaining movements. for resilience is embracing a total diversity of tactics. So different people have different ways of going about something, achieving something. So if a movement, as long as a movement can establish a goal in common, we can all push for that goal. And so we can sort of stay open-minded and respect the fact that other people's activism and other people's organizing isn't necessarily what ours looks like or what yours or mine looks like. And that's fine, because that is what is resilient. And as the opposition might come at certain facets of your campaign, others will arise and fill those gaps. So you're developing a really broad base of people who feel that what they have to offer is valuable, which it is, and that the diversity of tactics is completely, there's a richness to having all of those perspectives. And there's a great loss when campaigns narrow down or try to only approach things in one way. When the goal is set and when incremental changes start to happen, and it can be as something as simple as something appearing on the front page of the newspaper instead of on page 7, or whose voices are on the radio, who is talking about the issue, is it someone who's affected or is it not? That's when you start to have a little bit of hope and a little bit of resilience to sustain you. And when you see these little changes happening, it will sustain you. It'll do you good to see it working. So I think remembering then that all of those incremental changes, if you keep in mind that they're always working towards the goal, it's all building up to something. All of it matters. All of it is essential. And it's all going to combine for a great wave of change. But it has to be from the grassroots. I think that's how it works.
Earlier on, you mentioned community and space for fun and relaxation as being really, really important for successful, resilient activism. What challenges do you think lie ahead for activism in the current context, where so much of what we are used to in that respect is not available to us right now?
Yeah. I mean, when are we ever going to see a room or, say, like a lecture theatre full of people in the foreseeable future? We have to be really imaginative about how we're going to push forward. I think people who are activists at the moment are very adept at using social media and using just the internet, using Zoom, using Skype to communicate with each other. If we consider the immense talent that people have for making it work, because we have to make it work, then there is a way past. And I don't think that the format of how we meet is going to be too serious an issue. I think actually what we're facing into is an amazing time where we can see in, for example, America, the straw has broken the camel's back. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has been about to happen for such a long time, and it's happening now. And there are people who know exactly how to communicate with each other, who know how to get people's voices to the forefront. And it's that centering of the affected that is the priority, and the ways in which we do that will always arise, and people will always be imaginative about that. So the challenges aren't necessarily, I don't think, going to be pandemic related. I do think people will continue to protest on the streets. And I think it's just a very powerful and empowering and important form of protest. It is really empowering to be on the streets and to hear your own voice and to hear the voices of your friends and the people you stand with echoing through the street. If anything, I think resistance will come in the form of ignorance and a lack of attention and trying to make people think that now isn't the time, or that there's something else more important happening, or that we'll come back to it later. And actually, we need to stay resilient to the fact that that is a tactic that is being used against us to make us get tired and to make us stop, or to make us think that it's just not going to happen this time. We can take, I think, some solace from the fact that actually, no matter who is in power, the campaign remains the same, and affected-led groups exist, and they'll draw attention to what has to change. So if we focus on what they're saying, amplify people, support them and trust them that that is the path forward. And we can be motivated by a sort of a mixture of righteous anger and militant hope and realism that this is absolutely something, not only does it have to happen, but it can happen quickly and easily. And I mean, we've seen in the past few months with COVID how quickly things can adapt. So why can't we apply that agility to social movements? There's no reason. It's an absolute fallacy to pretend that systems can't change. It's a tactic of the system to make it seem like this behemoth, when actually it's populated by living people. And so if all of the power that's held in the country, in the legal system, in the guard, in the civil service, in the medical establishment, universities, property system, everything, if we can communicate with those people that this is how it has to be from now on, then that is how change is affected.
I'd wanted to ask you what your message or advice to campaigners right now would be for the way forward, but I think you've kind of preempted that. So I might ask you instead if, on a more personal level, you have any advice for someone who is thinking, can I go out and do another day of this right now?
My advice is, if you're burnt out, rest. That's the first thing. And it's very hard for activists because there is just an immense sense of guilt attached to that. I think everybody has a sense of what is right and what is unjust. Like, even four-year-olds know what's inherently unjust. And so it's very hard to separate that out from ourselves and our own demotivation and our own exhaustion, when actually what needs to happen is a rest. If you're demoralized because you think it's not working, keep in mind that that is a tool of your opposition. And your opposition could be the people who disagree with how you think, or your opposition could be an apathetic government. But the point remains that if you can recognize that you have an immense amount of power, you should use it. It is your responsibility to use it. You can't opt out of this. That actually the best thing you can do is to support the affected. And that goes for every single social movement. My advice would be, if you think you need a break, take a break. But if you can, now is the moment, and we should seize this moment for change because it is happening at this very minute. I think the pandemic, as I said, the swiftness with which the whole system was able, or the market was able to adapt to the COVID pandemic, has demonstrated to us that actually, yes, we could do the same thing with the greater good in mind. So be radical, be imaginative, and be very hopeful, because it is absolutely within our reach. Exhaustion and apathy are being weaponized against us. But if you just put your shoulder to the wheel where it's most effective and give it everything, then that's all you can do. Use what's in your arsenal, use whatever skills or capacity that you have, do the most good that you can do. It is important, it does matter. It is important that you show up. People, I don't want to say people will be grateful, because it's not really about gratitude. It's about being decent. It's about doing what's right, I think. So use your anger, and remember that it's not naive to be hopeful, I think. And just do your best.
Thanks so much for your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Emily.
I want to end with one more huge thank you to Michelle and Claire for the really interesting conversations. I hope that you, the listeners, got as much out of them as I did. If you're interested in more COVID-19 supports and resources for your own organisation, visit wheel.ie and click on the COVID-19 tab. You can also take a look at our policy section to see how we're approaching campaigning and change during this time. We always love to hear your comments, questions, and ideas for future podcast guests. You can find The Wheel on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @the_wheel_IRL, or email me at emily@wheel.ie. Join us next time when we speak to HR and fundraising experts about business-level concerns and COVID-19 resilience. It's important material for anyone concerned with their organisational logistics at the moment, and well worth tuning into. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.